In this hour, we will be talking about the life and work of the great wildlife artist John James Audubon, and our guest is Richard Rhodes. He is the author of a new biography titled John James Audubon, The Making of an American. It's published by Knopf and is just recently out. Rhodes says that Audubon is the great American artist that no one knows. He also says that Audubon's life is a great example of how America became America. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Our guest, Richard Rhodes, is the author of 20 books, including The Making of the Atomic Bomb, which won a Pulitzer Prize in nonfiction, a National Book Award, and a National Book Critics Circle Award. Another book, Dark Sun, The Making of the Hydrogen Bomb, was shortlisted for a Pulitzer Prize in history. He's been a visiting scholar at Harvard and MIT, host and correspondent for documentaries on public television's Frontline and American Experience series, and also currently he's researching a third volume of Nuclear History Endgame that will look at the international politics of nuclear weapons across the past two decades. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Rhodes, hello.
Good morning.
Well, thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I think that I remember reading in one of the things that I read about you in the book that this was the first book that you have written that was not set in the 20th century.
Yes, although I have to qualify that. I realized later that my first novel was about the Donner Party. But certainly this is the first work of nonfiction that I've written that's not set in the 20th century.
Well, so mostly you have the history that you have explored is the history of the 20th century.
Exactly.
What is it that you found so engaging and so interesting about Audubon that you wanted to put in the considerable amount of work that it took to assemble this book?
Well, besides being a charming and extraordinarily interesting man, just because of the ups and downs of his life and his huge ambition and his great success. I have always been intrigued. Many of my books have been about America and who we are and how we came to be who we are. Early on in my career, for example, I wrote a guidebook to the Ozark Semi-Wilderness for the Time Life Wilderness series. So I've been interested in America, and here was a man who came of age at a time when we were becoming a nation, and who led an exemplary and fascinating life himself. So he was someone who really was worth spending 2.5 years with. I got to like him better the more I researched his writing.
Mm. Well, the way that you talk about him as being charming, charismatic, he was very handsome, maybe a little bit vain about his looks.
Yes, yes.
That he would have been, I think, again, I read somewhere you saying something like, this was the guy, if you were having a party, this was the man that you would want at your party.
Well, you know, as a young adult, when he arrived in America at the age of 18, from France, where he had grown up, he was trained in fencing well enough that later in life he taught fencing. He was an elegant dancer and actually taught dancing for a living at one point. He played the violin and the flageolet, which was a kind of recorder, and maybe played the guitar as well. That's not quite so clear. He ice skated beautifully at a time when ice skating in Pennsylvania, where he lived for several years, was a favorite sport of young people. So he rode horses beautifully. He was just the kind of person that both men and women enjoyed being around.
His father was French. Audubon himself was born in Haiti, and then his father brought him back to France, and he was not married to Audubon's mother, but apparently Audubon was accepted into the family, and in fact the wife of his father, his father's wife, accepted him as well. That would seem to me perhaps to be a little unusual.
I think it was unusual. Audubon's mother was a chambermaid in his father's house on a sugar plantation in Haiti, at a time when that was the leading French colony abroad. And when the first signs of slave rebellion, which turned that country upside down, came to light in the early 1790s, his father took him back to France. He was his father's only son. His father was an older man at that point. And his father's wife in France was 7 years older than his father. She was an older widow, childless, whom his father had married probably for the convenience of both of them, I mean, to merge their properties and so on. But they clearly liked each other and got along. And this woman found this little boy charming, just as everyone would find him charming for most of his life. There's an extract, a sentence from a letter she wrote to her husband that I think gives a wonderful sense of how she felt about this little boy, whom she adopted and gave her name to. She wrote, "He's the handsomest boy in France, but perhaps not the most studious." So clearly she liked him and was happy to have him around and raised him well.
It seems that if you look at, ask questions about what sort of life experiences shaped his character, it seems pretty clear that the experiences that he had in his family had living through and surviving the French Revolution were very important in establishing the base for this person that he would become.
You know, he really did go through a great deal of trauma as a boy. His mother died of an infection when he was 6 months old, which is why, of course, his father could return him to France, because his mother was gone. So he was a half orphan by the time he was 1 year old. He, in France, the family, yes, went through the French Revolution, lost much of their wealth, as did so many other people. The school system broke down during the French Revolution, so his education was truncated. Evidently, it stopped at about the age of 14. And he was, throughout his life, embarrassed and sensitive about his lack of education when he was around more educated people, even though he was a superb field naturalist as an adult. Then they went through the Terror, which I think is not understood very well today, but it was something like going through the kind of violence and horror that's going on right now in Iraq, in the city of Nantes, where he and his family lived on the Loire River in the west of France. There were hundreds and thousands of people slaughtered by the official authorities because there had been a counter-revolution there and they were putting it down. The family, the Audubon family, was actually thrown in jail and barely escaped with their lives. So he had a full measure of traumatic experience as a boy, something that's been generally passed over by his previous biographers. I think it's important to his... I mean, he studied birds and drew birds as a way of understanding the world. And by that I mean almost allegorically. He saw, if you will, the human world through the world of birds. So even though he was an extroverted person and enjoyed being around people, a deeper strain in his character was his pleasure in being in the woods and being away from people. He would say at later points in his life, when he was frustrated with the production of his work or something, "Well, I could always just go back to the forest and my beloved birds and escape all this discomfort and unhappiness." So he really did have a sense of birds as the essence of freedom, of birds as creatures that had complex lives as human beings do. And in this naturalism that he came to, I think he found a way to work through the very complex feelings that a sensitive human being is left with when they go through these difficult childhood experiences.
Hmm. That gets at the interesting and tantalizing question of why birds. Obviously, he had artistic talent, perhaps a natural talent. He was not a bad portrait artist, and he could have probably done other sorts of things. And maybe even if he was going to be a wildlife artist, he could have done other sorts of things. But obviously, what we know him for is his great love of birds and his extraordinarily beautiful depictions of them.
And in his writings, his very detailed and perspicacious study of their behavior, because along with the Birds of America, his great work of drawings and engravings, he also wrote 5 volumes of what he called ornithological biography, which was a detailed description of the behavior and lives and anatomy and appearance of all the birds that were depicted in the other work. So he really did turn to this as a way of exploring himself in the world. Why birds? I think because after the Revolution and after the Terror, his father retired from the French Navy, and they moved downriver from Nantes to a little village called Couronne, where they had his father and mother had a substantial country house, which is still there, by the way, and the city of Nantes has recently purchased it for a museum of Audubon materials. Next door to the little village, within easy walking distance of his house, was a former marsh, which was now a dense and wonderful forest. It's still there today, and it's called the Audubon Forest. His father was interested in walking out into the woods with him and showing him the life there and talking about it. His father had a good friend who was a doctor named D'Orbigny, who also served as one of young Audubon's mentors and who had two sons who became great French naturalists in their own right, which suggests, I think, what a good teacher he was. Between these two men and perhaps others as well, Audubon was at a very vulnerable part in his early adolescence, was exposed to the world of natural creatures, and particularly of birds, and began drawing them. His earliest drawings date back to his early adolescence. So there was, I think, a connection there that had to do with the guidance that his mentors and teachers gave him.
He did, as you say, spend a lot of time outdoors in nature. He was spent a lot of time particularly observing birds. He was taught to do dissection. He was taught to do taxidermy,
right.
Which was really necessary to his later art. He spent to produce the Birds of America, spent an awful lot of time observing birds in the wild. But and this is something that I think perhaps sometimes people have a hard time with, the notion that in order to do these pictures,
yes,
he had to kill the birds,
right,
at some point, because the essential quality of these portraits is the composition and the way that the birds are posed and the way that they're shown. And apparently,
exactly,
what he did was he had to kill the birds and pose them, the dead birds, pose them to use that as his models for the paintings that he would do. And I think that a lot of people just have a hard time putting together the love of birds and these beautiful pictures and Audubon and the way that we think about,
right,
the natural world and wanting to preserve it with, on the other hand, the fact that he, and in the course of his life, probably killed an awful lot of birds.
That's true. I think people who don't know anything else about Audubon often know that he had to shoot the birds in order to draw them, and they're maybe horrified. But let's be clear, there were no cameras in 1810. There were not even any binoculars in 1810. The only way that you could get close to a bird and make it stand still long enough to draw it was to kill it. And indeed, he was just doing what all ornithologists and naturalists did in those days, with the significant difference that ornithology was kind of a closet science, as he called it, and at that time. The scientist would stay at home in Philadelphia, let's say, and he would hire one of the many market hunters who shot birds, because all wild birds, not only what we think of today as game birds, but also songbirds, were harvested for food in that era when America had very little agriculture going yet, mostly just small farm subsistence agriculture with not a lot of food prepared for the market. Birds were shot in enormous numbers for the city markets. Audubon once remembered seeing in 1805 an entire barge load of passenger pigeons, a kind of very delicious wild pigeon, floating down the Hudson River for the markets of New York. And he found them, the birds, in all the city markets the next day for sale for 5 cents apiece. So he was doing something that was normal for the era at a time when people thought of birds rather the way we think of fish, as simply a natural resource to be harvested in whatever quantity we need. Previous ornithologists, however, had not worked with fresh specimens. They had sent the market hunter out to collect birds for them. And what he would do is skin the bird he'd shot, preserve the skin with arsenic powder, wrap it around a piece of frayed rope stuffing, and then that would go back to the scientist, so-called, for him to try to make some sense out of the anatomy and structure of a bird when all he had was the skin. Audubon understood that to depict a bird in as lifelike as possible, you would need to work with a freshly killed specimen, which is why, unlike the closet ornithologist, he was out in the field. He would study the birds and observe their behavior and take elaborate notes on a daily basis. And then he would try to decide, based on the behavior of the bird when it was alive, what position he wanted to draw it in, maybe flying or nesting, maybe courting, whatever it was going to be. He would study that first in the living bird. Then he would collect a specimen or two or three, looking for the healthiest and the most representative. And within 24 hours of its death, would have finished a drawing of it. He said that even the color of feathers changed within 24 hours. And then because he was out in the wilderness and there were no stores around, he would typically use the specimen for food. He would cook it and eat it. So that in the ornithological biography, over and over again with all these 500 species of birds, he discusses what they taste like. Again, this may seem a little shocking today, but I think you have to remember that birds were collected. What Audubon brought to his depiction of birds was that he didn't depict them as if they were just fish. He didn't depict them as if they had no feeling life of their own. To the contrary, I think his real gift to the conservation and environmental movements of today was that he was one of the first to show all these living species of creatures as having complex behaviors and lives, as protecting their young, as courting and loving, in a sense, to a couple of birds living together and reproducing and so forth. He showed them in all the richness of their complex behaviors, and in doing so, introduced that idea to a world that had not taken birds seriously in that sense before.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Richard Rhodes, and he's the author of a newly published biography of Audubon, John James Audubon. It's titled John James Audubon, The Making of an American, and it's published by Knopf, and the book is out just now. Richard Rhodes is the author of a number of books, including a series that looks at the history of nuclear weapons, and he may well be best known for his book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb, which won a Pulitzer Prize in nonfiction. Not only that, but also National Book Award and the National Book Critics Circle Award. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. As we mentioned, you told a little bit of the story about the fact that how he was born. He was born in Haiti. His father brought him back to France when Audubon was six, and then when he was 18, sent him to the United States. And I gather he was that his Audubon's father was concerned that Audubon would end up being pressed into the French army.
Yep.
And so he decided better to send the boy to the United States than have him end up serving under Napoleon.
Yes, well, he didn't want him turned into cannon fodder, and this was his only son. So it was very important to him that his son survived, so he procured him a false passport, which said he'd been born in Louisiana, which he had not. Audubon kind of covered up his birth because it was a great source of shame in that society at that time to have been born illegitimate. So he often would say he was born in the New World, which technically was true since he was born in Haiti. So he came to America at 18, and his father had bought a substantial farm near Valley Forge in Pennsylvania, which was called Mill Grove because it was on a lovely little creek, and there was a mill down on the creek as well that was part of the property. So for the next couple of years, Audubon lived the life of a sort of young country gentleman, going to parties and riding horses, hunting and collecting birds and studying birds. He was by then fully engaged in the whole idea that he was going to study the rich new source of birds in America, many of which had never been identified or described or even named yet. So it was a great opportunity for him. Next door, on the estate up the hill from Mill Grove, an English family had just at that time moved in, the Bakewell family, who were wealthy and substantial and who had come to America basically for religious reasons to follow the chemist and religious leader Joseph Priestley, who had established a colony in Pennsylvania. So the Bakewells moved in just about the time Audubon moved in. The oldest Bakewell daughter, Lucy Bakewell, was a lovely young woman. She was tall and slim, and she had smoky gray eyes and a cute upturned English nose, and was well-educated for a young woman of her day in England before she came over, was a good horsewoman. She rode side saddle, even was a strong swimmer, something of an athlete. So these two handsome, intelligent, talented young people inevitably met and fell in love. Audubon actually took the risk of going back to France to get his father's permission to marry her, risking once again the draft, and his father had to secrete him out of France once more. But by 1808, he and Lucy, John James and Lucy, had married and were prepared to move, like so many young people at that particular time in American history, to move across the Appalachians to Louisville to open a general store.
We have a couple of callers, and I'd like to bring them into the conversation. Why don't we do that? And we'll start with someone here where we are in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hello. I'm learning so much from this. I have two comments and also one question. The comments are, I love birds, and I realized that there was no camera, so Audubon's drawings do not offend me. The fact that he tastes like the birds does not offend me. My question is, do you think that planes, the relationship between birds and planes is one I would like your guest to clarify? And I'll hang up and listen to the answer. Thank you so much.
I'm not in
birds and planes.
I think that's what the caller said. I don't know if she was thinking about the what observing, what we can say about the history of flight and the attempts of flight. How observing, what's the relationship between observing birds and human beings thinking about, I wish I could do that, and how could I possibly do that?
I live on the shore of the Pacific Ocean, and I see birds go by, and I still think I wish I could do that. It's so extraordinary. It's really too early in the Audubon era for anything to, I think, have passed in that regard. Although, Lord knows, all the way back to Leonardo da Vinci, there was an effort to try to figure out how to make a plane basically by looking at the way birds flew. What was happening in those days, however, and what Audubon saw when he went to France later on in his career to try to get subscribers for his Birds of America, was hot air balloons. There was a great deal of that going around. And there's a story that I tell that I think is really fascinating. About the time Audubon was in France, some Osage Indians had been shipped over by an entrepreneur who was going to exhibit them around Europe. And one of them went up in a hot air balloon and was willing to go because his particular gem, his particular clan, was the Eagle Clan. So he knew that he was all right going up in the air like that. When the Osage came back to America, one of them said he'd been married three times to the ladies of the French court while he was in France. So it was really quite an encounter between some Native Americans. Audubon had hunted with Osage Indians when he was living in Kentucky, so he knew that particular group very well.
All right, let's talk with someone else. This caller is in Atlanta, Illinois, not Georgia, on our line four. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Guys are talking about one of my favorite individuals.
Oh, good.
I might have missed this in trying to call in, but is it true that Audubon was a really great marksman in the fact that that's one of the abilities he had to gather some of his samples? And then one other thing that I find might be informative, the state of Illinois has a tremendous collection of Audubon prints, original prints, that I don't know whether they're on permanent expedition or not, but they do travel around quite a bit, and mainly they're prints that would depict birds in Illinois, and they're just, when you see them, it's just stunning. I mean, it's just unbelievable, those large of prints and that many in one place to look at and then relate them to what birds you know about. It's pretty good. So I'll ask the question about the marksman ability, and you might have covered that, and I'll hang up. Thank you very much.
All right.
Audubon was a good marksman. He had to be. He was firing a smoothbore gun or a shotgun, but the shotgun was for small birds, basically, and he would load it with mustard seed because he didn't want to damage the specimen if he could avoid it. But for larger birds at longer distances, he fired a muzzle-loaded smoothbore gun with a lead ball that he dropped in the front end of the thing. He was a very good shot, obviously, and it was one of the qualities that made him so popular in rural frontier Kentucky, because they would have shooting matches. They would do things like barking a squirrel, which would mean shooting at the bark directly below a squirrel in a tree to see if you could knock the squirrel out of the tree. And Audubon was often a winner at these matches, as he often was at the impromptu horse races that they held, derbies that they held in the streets of Louisville and Henderson, the town he lived in on the frontier. I think it's very interesting to ask the question, to jump ahead in Audubon's story a little bit. Mm-hmm. When he arrived in England in the autumn, the late summer of 1826, with his portfolio of drawings to find and engage an engraver who could turn his drawings into the big, wonderful plates of the Birds of America. He knew no one. He had a purse full of letters of introduction, but he was basically a totally unknown person. The people in England had never heard of him. He had no reputation yet anywhere at all. And within a month or two after he arrived, he was like a rock star. He was famous all over the country, and people were flocking to the exhibitions of his drawings. And the question really is, how did that happen? And one of the answers is, when he rented a hall and lined the walls of that room with these 3 foot by 4 foot life-sized, brilliantly colored watercolor and pencil drawings of birds set in their natural habitat with the trees behind them that they might nest in or feed on, or the plants, or the shore, water shore where they swam, or the lake. When you walked into a room in those days when there were no mechanically reproduced images, when everything that was available in image form was handmade, when there were no aniline dyes, so the world was drab and dark with just vegetable dyes, usually dark clothing, when the cities of England were dark and sooty with coal smoke, you walked into a room with this brilliantly colored reproduction of the wilderness around you, and I think it would have been like today going to an IMAX theater. People were simply dazzled by this man's work. They had never seen anything like it. People didn't draw birds that way before Audubon. They drew them like little lumps standing on tree branches. And here was this animated life of these creatures. So I think that explains a lot about why he was so great and immediate a success when he went to England, as he had not been in the United States.
Hmm. Well, you talked about the fact a little earlier when he came to the United States, one of the things that he was very excited about was the opportunity to get to know the flora and fauna of the new place, and also to use his art to depict that. And he was, but it seems pretty clear that the thing that motivated him to do it was the love of doing it. And he loved doing it, and he wanted it to be really good, that periodically as he was developing his skills, he would destroy everything that he'd done.
That's right.
As a way to spur himself to doing better the next time. So he wasn't thinking about this as a commercial enterprise.
No, in fact, he really didn't think of himself as an artist until after he failed at business during the Panic of 1819. Before that time, he had been an owner and operator of general stores and trader in real estate, and had built at great expense with a couple partners who ducked out on him when the going got tough, a big steam-powered grist and sawmill on the Ohio River in Henderson, Kentucky, which was right on the edge of the frontier at that time. So, indeed, in the prime years of his business activity, between 1810 and 1819, there are very few drawings that survive. People have accused him of neglecting his business for birds and use that to explain the business failure. But to the contrary, he neglected his birding, his hobby, at that time, for business, until the Panic of 1819 brought all the businesses west of the Appalachians low. It was not unique to Audubon that he went broke that year, because the federal government had called in all its loans. The federal bank in Philadelphia had called in all its loans to all the new little state banks in the west in order to put together enough gold and silver to finish paying the Louisiana Purchase. And it had basically caused a financial collapse throughout the entire Trans-Appalachian West, one of the reasons that Andrew Jackson would be elected president a few years later, because the West was so incensed at what it thought of as the Eastern bankers for having destroyed their world. Almost every business west of the Appalachians failed in 1819. And it was only then, when Audubon had to find another way to support his family, that he turned to making black chalk portraits for a living, at a time when usually the only way you could get a portrait of someone in your family was to pay $1,000 or more in modern dollars for an oil painting. He was willing to produce a decent black chalk portrait for $5, which would be about $100 today. So he quickly was able to make a living as an artist, and that was one of the revelations of experiences that he had at that time that led him to realize he could indeed do that. He had also seen his immediate predecessor's books of American birds, a man named Alexander Wilson. And he knew that Wilson was not nearly the artist he was. He knew that his field observations were as good as Wilson's. And he knew that Wilson had primarily focused on the birds of the eastern flyway and had not really encompassed in his several volumes of American Birds the numerous species that flew up and down the Mississippi flyway. So he saw, number one, that he could make a living as an artist, and number two, that a predecessor who had sold well, had done books that had been financially successful, had not covered the entire known or, if you will, white settled part of America yet. So Audubon envisioned a larger work with all the birds life-sized on these huge pages, and he hoped at that point in 1820, 1821, he hoped that he could cover the entire continent. As it turned out, because there was so much danger in going west in the 1830s, he really was never able to get all the way to California. He got as far west as the Rockies, but never really crossed the Rockies. So his life experience is what turned him from a hobbyist who was fascinated with wilderness and the natural world into an artist who could take all that knowledge that he had accrued for his own pleasure and turn it into works of art and instruction for the rest of the world.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Richard Rhodes, and he's the author of John James Audubon, The Making of an American, a new biography of the artist. It's published by Knopf, and it's just out. And again, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You talked about the fact that Audubon went to Britain and was a smash hit. He and his artwork were smash hit, became very, very famous and celebrated, and that helped then. He first became famous in England before he came back and became famous in the United States.
Right.
His reason, though, for going to Britain was that this was the time that he wanted to have the drawings published and reproduced, and apparently there was nobody in the United States that could do it, not do it the way that he wanted to do it.
Yeah, I mean, there were people in the United States who could engrave large copper plates like that, but this was a venture that in the end, in modern dollars, was going to cost $2.5 million. At the height of production in London, he had an entire workshop of engravers and printers working, and 50 colorers who hand-colored the finished engraved plates to put in the watercolor washes that would make them be full-color plates. This was a huge enterprise, and it simply was not any publishing institution in this country at that time capable of handling an enterprise on that scale. He knew that as early as 1821. So he planned, and here let's introduce into the story his wife Lucy, because Lucy is someone who's been left out of previous biographies by and large. Indeed, has been described as some sort of unwilling victim to Audubon's ambitions, who had to endure poverty and separation and indeed had to support their children at one point while he went abroad to get this great work done. That's not the way it happened. I've read through the letters and correspondence between these two people who were deeply in love, who were married happily for 43 years. When Audubon decided after the business failure that he was going to take on this grand work, Lucy was an enthusiastic participant in the decision. She saw it as a way, first of all, to recoup the family fortunes, second, as a way to increase this family's status in America, and most perhaps importantly, she knew that her husband was deeply shamed and guilty about having failed in business, even though he was part of a larger phenomenon that he had no control over. And she saw this as a way for him to recoup his pride. So she told him, I will help you find the money. We will both go to work, and I will help you put together the stake you need to take this work to England to be started. At the same time, while you're abroad, I will support myself and pay for our schooling for our two children while you're getting started. And then when you're settled and you've got a flow of income from the work, then I'll come over and join you and we can be together again. So he and she found their way down to Louisiana to the wealthy cotton plantations above New Orleans on the Mississippi River. In those days, three good cotton crops made you a millionaire on the Mississippi River above New Orleans. There were more millionaires in that stretch of the river than there were in New York City at the time. It was And these people had, of course, children. They wanted their children to have training and deportment and the best possible sort of gentleman's and young ladies' education. So Lucy started a school on one of the plantations where she taught piano and other subjects to the young women of the rich families. And he started a rather more informal operation where he taught fencing to the young men. He taught dancing to the whole community. They would come into one of the plantations and clear out one of the cotton barns, move the gin aside, and Mr. Audubon would collect a little fee from everybody. And then accompanying himself on his violin, he would teach them the cotillion, which was kind of an early French version of square dancing. He also taught drawing, of course, so, and maybe French as well. So between them, they went to work to put the money together to get him abroad. At the same time, in Louisiana, he was able to collect maybe 65 or even 100 different species of birds. There were so many birds there coming down in the winters from the north.
You talked about how expensive it was simply to have the plates reproduced. You're talking millions of dollars just to produce the Birds of America. If in 1850 you wanted to have a copy, what would it have cost?
Well, the selling price of the set at the time was £1,000, which translates in modern dollars to about $15,000. So when Audubon started the production of this book of 435 3-foot by 4-foot copper plate engravings, hand-colored, based on his original drawings, he knew he had to get a cash flow going. And the tradition with this kind of book in those days was that you would solicit subscribers, which he personally went out and did all over England. You would produce 5 finished plates, put these into a portfolio, and ship them off to a subscriber who would pay for those 5 plates. This unit was called a number. They would pay for a number, a certain set amount, and then 5 more plates would come as another number in a month or two, and so on until till 100 plates had been accumulated, and then they would have them bound into the first volume of the book. And they could have any kind of binding they wanted, leather or buckram, with any kind of scroll work, with a lock, if you'd like a lock. So this provided a basic cash flow for the business. But it wasn't enough to pay for this very expensive production process. So Audubon also painted large oil canvases of natural scenes for the country gentry to put up in their big country houses and sold those for the modern equivalent of $10,000 or $15,000 each. And also later when he also had exhibitions of the drawings, and then as the plates started to be available, of the plates as well, in halls around England, and would charge admission. So he had these various ways. I mean, it's extraordinary to me that this one man managed this vast operation. He said proudly at the end of the 12-year period of production, because that's how long it took to make this book, he said, "I never missed a payroll," meaning those 50 young women colorists and the printers and the engravers. Every week he made the payroll. Every week he made sure that his engraver, Robert Havell Jr. in London, had enough drawings to produce the next number. And that meant that he had to go back to America frequently to do new collections, to do more expeditions. He went to Labrador. He went into the Floridas. He spent a summer at Great Egg Harbor in New Jersey, a major nesting place for birds. He went all the way as far west along the Gulf as the Galveston Bay, and even went up to what was then a very raw little village called Houston, and met a very raw president of the new country of Texas named Sam Houston, living in a log cabin. He wandered all over America, but he had the birds, he had the drawings, he had the payroll ready exactly at the right time. The business was never impeded by him. He serviced all the subscribers. When they fell off the list, he'd go back and convince them to sign on again. Or if they died, he'd convince their heirs to sign on and continue. He was a one-man band in the most extraordinary way. Mm. So if anyone thinks he was a bad businessman, they should look at what he did with this work to change their judgment.
We have about 10 minutes left, maybe a little bit more, in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Richard Rhodes. His new book is John James Audubon, The Making of an American. It's published by Knopf. We have some callers to talk with. Someone listening in Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. One question both you and Dave took care of, and that was sort of the actual mechanics of the size of the paper and the copper plates and how why it went to England and stuff. I'd like to carry that on a little further in a more, a smaller area in terms of aesthetics. Did they do a number of prints of each plate? And if so, how many normally? And was there any question later on after the 12 years are over whether or not... my print's better than your print because my pink is closer to the pink of the actual bird, that kind of question. And the next question is somebody that seems to be fairly important of, in terms of genes passed on is, what can you tell us about his mother? I haven't heard anything at all about her. She's just sort of a, you know, a lady to procreate from, I guess. But I was wondering if you could give a little more about her, you know.
Sure. His natural mother, whose name was Jean Rabin, was born in a village close to Nantes, the city that Audubon would then grow up in, and seems to have passed over to Saint-Dominique, as Haiti was then called, on the same ship that carried Audubon's father, so on one of his voyages. That's probably where they met. But almost nothing else is known about her. She was a chambermaid in his father's house. He said he heard from someone that his mother was extraordinarily beautiful, and he tended to make up stories about his childhood and claimed that his mother was a Spanish lady in Louisiana because, again, he was hiding his illegitimacy. So not very much is known about his mother other than, as has recently been established, where she was born and how she when she came to America, or to Saint-Dominique, I should say. There were about 200 plates pulled for each of the pages of the Birds of America. Ultimately, there were about 185 original sets, of which probably 120 or so still survive in their bound form. For many years, it was more profitable to take apart a set and sell the plates individually than to leave them all together in their original bindings, unfortunately. So there are, for each plate now, about 40 individual plates wandering around the world in private hands and in public hands. But in the year 2000, Christie's sold a very fine set of the complete bound Birds of America to the Emir of Qatar for $8.8 million, the highest price ever paid for an art book. The Emir is building a world-class science library, and this was to be the jewel in the crown of that library. As a result, no one is ever again going to break up sets of the Birds of America because the finished bound set is worth more than all the individual plates sold separately, which I think is good news. I think one of the reasons Audubon is not as celebrated as an American artist as I think he should be is because it's so very hard to see his work. And his work, in his eyes, was not the original drawings, but rather the copper plate engravings, which, of course, were done by someone else, which makes it very difficult for art curators and museums to decide what's the original work. So they tend to put an engraved plate up on the wall and list it as by Robert Havell Jr. after John James Audubon. But Audubon didn't think of it that way. When he did these wonderful, wonderful works, which are kind of, I call them concentrated essence of wilderness, because it's more than just the depiction of a bird. It's the depiction of a whole world, especially when you see these all together, either in sequence in the book or out on a wall. His idea of the finished work was the plate, and his drawings are often unfinished. All of his drawings, except a couple that had been destroyed, were sold by Lucy after his death to the New York Historical Society, which still has them. In fact, is having an exhibition of some of them next in February in New York for people who are interested. And they're often not finished. There's often no background. Sometimes there's a pencil note Mr. Havell will fill in the background. Sometimes he cuts out a bird from one drawing and glues it onto another in a sort of collage. So they're really works prepared for the engraver. And I think that's one of the reasons it's been hard for Audubon to receive the recognition he should.
We have another caller. Let's go here to someone here, line number one, listening in Crete, Illinois. Hello.
Yeah, this nation's inundated with the bird complex. We have the turkey, we have the American bald eagle, we have Hitchcock's The Birds, we have,
yes.
We have your new book, and just yesterday in the Chicago Tribune on the front page, there was a statement made by scientists saying that the chicken's DNA offers a great glimpse into our past, also into the human psychology and physiology.
Yes.
So the DNA of the chicken might be another book you might consider.
Evidently, chickens are about 60% the same DNA as we are, which shouldn't surprise any of us. Nature is very conservative in evolution.
You know, I was amazed by the fact that in the time frame and the location frame of the early 19th century in the far west of Kentucky, we could have a merger of some very important people. Daniel Boone was probably on his way to Missouri by this time, but certainly this was his area.
Yes.
Lewis and Clark were beginning their great journey to the west around 1804. Abraham Lincoln, a young kid someplace in Kentucky, was being born about this time.
Right.
And, of course, a little further south, Andy Jackson was raising hell. So we do have a merger of many things here as far as personalities. We also have a merger, in the case of Audubon, with a number of important events, the Haitian Revolution and the Toussaint Louverture,
right.
French Revolution of the 1790s, the Great Migration beginning in the 19th century to the United States from Europe,
right.
Also the Great Migration to the West, which he, in a sense, initiated to some extent, and the great interest in science, especially science in the American frontier.
Yes. No, you're absolutely right about all these things. And indeed, Audubon was a good friend of William Clark's. There were Clarks all over Louisville, and they became friends throughout their lives. And Mary Todd's father, who was a banker, wrote a letter of recommendation for Audubon in 1819 when he was looking for a job teaching at a college in Cincinnati. So there really was a great deal of overlap. This brings up the other theme that I've tried to explore in this book that I think, again, has not been looked at by previous Audubon biographers. There was at this time a great migration west. There was at this time, starting around 1800, what the historian Joyce Appleby calls the first generation of Americans moving out from the east, moving out from the tidewater part of the United States, leaving behind their parents. The first generation of Americans, young people who for the first time really thought of themselves as Americans. Their parents, like first-generation immigrants today, had thought of themselves perhaps as French or German or English, wherever they came from. This new generation really began in their life experiences, changing careers, which had really not been possible previously, and not had been part of the tradition of the families, moving away from home, establishing their own traditions, exploring their own possibilities with this great open-ended frontier out there as a canvas on which to paint. These young people and their life experiences created or established the kind of qualities that we now think of as the American character. That is to say, intense individualism, optimism, entrepreneurial ambitions, a certain brashness and boldness and roughness of character that to this day Europeans attach to us as a people. Audubon's life, however unique, however distinctive in terms of his particular gifts, and Lucy's life as well, are very representative of this time in American life that has been not much explored by historians, but when America came together as a nation. And I think that's one of the qualities that people can take as a larger subject of Audubon's life beyond simply his wonderful work as an artist and as a writer.
You speak as well as you write, and you can see, David, why he's an excellent writer, because of his spark of interest in these subjects and his great enthusiasm for his
Thank you.
Absolutely true. I would not disagree at all. We're coming down to the point where we're almost have to finish, and I would just again suggest that people, if they're interested in the subject, they should go and they should take a look at the book, because it really is a very, very fascinating story. Maybe again just to finish up to this idea that you write about in the book, that one of the reasons that perhaps you're fascinated by Audubon is how he exemplifies America's tendency to invent themselves.
Yes.
And that there's this sort of tie, this parallel between America and what it is and Audubon and who he was?
Audubon's been rather put down for having basically invented a persona for himself, even though today that's considered a great virtue, and most of our celebrities do just that. I think it really came to a focus when he arrived in England, because he became the life of everybody's dinner party. He was invited out almost every night of the week, much to his discomfort and exhaustion, because he had to work all day, by turning himself into a kind of a rough frontier American character. I mean, he simplified himself. People would ask him at dinner, "Mr. Audubon, could you give us an Indian war whoop, or could you give us an owl call, Mr. Audubon?" So he would play this kind of game. And he had arrived in rough frontier clothes with his hair down to his shoulders, very unfashionable look, but very frontier and romantic Western look, if you will. So he played himself in a way and this was one of the discoveries I made that fascinated me. The Last of the Mohicans had been published in England about 6 months before Audubon arrived, and it had been a huge national bestseller. People were ready for Natty Bumppo to step off the boat, and that's exactly what happened. But on a deeper level, Audubon really came to think of himself, again going back to this theme of the country becoming a nation at that time, he began to think of himself as an American. The ring that he had made to seal his letters with red wax, as they did in those days, had his wild turkey cock carved on it. And around the rim of the seal was "America, my country," which had become his motto by then. So he really did deeply identify with this new and rich and wonderful and extraordinary land, filled with wild creatures, filled with birds, and took that as his character, just as so many other Americans were doing.
Yeah, we'll have to leave it there. I'm sorry to have to stop. You should read the book. It's titled John Jape's Audubon, The Making of an American, published by Knopf, by our guest Richard Rhodes. And thank you very much, Mr. Rhodes,
for talking to me. My pleasure. Thank you.